Session number 3167.
Aubrey Elwood, Reel 2. What sort of planes was your squadron operating with at Umballa?
Bristol fighters. It was an aeroplane. I had just flown one once or twice before, so I had been introduced to it. But that was at Freeston. We had one or two there.
Shortly after you'd arrived in India, you were actually transferred for a time to Bangalore to Number 3 Squadron, where you were operating with a different different plane.
It went back to fighters again, but this time a thing called a snipe. We'd been flying Pups and Sopwith again, so Pups and Camels in the war, during the war, and then the snipe came in. I don't think it actually ever went into service in the war, as far as I remember, but we had it at Freeston. And that's what we had down in Bangalore. But they didn't keep us there for very long because there was really no point in having that sort of aircraft at all. And I don't know quite why they did it. It was a very curious decision. And eventually they sent one squadron to Iraq. Or, yes, I think it was called Iraq then. It was Mesopotamia, what was known as Mesopotamia before. And my squadron was disbanded, and we went back. I went back again to the same squadron in Umballa as I started on, though I think it was now called 28 Squadron for some reason. About that time, anyway, it changed its number to 28. It's the same squadron, and I stayed there for. Well, I wasn't there very long, but it was just beginning of the hot weather. Eventually, I went up to the hills, to a hill station, and then joined 31 Squadron, which was another Army Cooperation Squadron, which I had never seen before. That was, in fact, it was the first squadron that was ever formed in India. I joined them actually while they were up at the hill station, and then we went down to move. It was in Cawnpore at the time, and then we, before the cold weather came on, after the hill station period, we went to Peshawar on the northwest frontier, and I was with them for, what was it, 2 years or so, till the end of 1923 at any rate, and that's where we went on with doing ordinary Army Cooperation work, training, and to a certain extent in operations in the northwest frontier.
Were conditions at Peshawar fairly, as regards living and so on, fairly similar to Umballa? Were any places in India at that time much better or much worse that you went to than others as regards accommodation and facilities?
No, I think that there were some. Well, for instance, when we went to Peshawar, I was married by that time, and we had a quite a modern bungalow at first, but that was pure chance. It wasn't. They just happened to have built some newer ones, and I started off life there in a fairly new one. Later on, I moved to one of the older bungalows. There's nothing, there's no difference really, except that the shower was earlier, I think, quicker in having in having electricity than we were at Umballa. But Umballa, for instance, when we went back to Umballa, I know I mentioned, I think, on the last tape, but it may not have come out, that we had no electricity. Well, we hadn't when I was first there, but when we came back, the place had been wired for electricity, but unfortunately the electricity hadn't arrived, you see.
What sort
And
of, what, how did you manage for lighting? What sort of lighting did you
oh,
have?
had lamps, oil lamps, and candles, of course, but mainly oil lamps. Well, the thing that mattered most was about the electricity was that. This was just beginning, just as the hot weather was beginning, and it would have been very nice to have an electric fan, but we hadn't got any. We had one punka, as it was called. You probably heard of a punka, if you've ever read, watched It Ain't Half Hot on the Wireless TV. There it was. And that's the all we had to keep us cool. Well, this bungalow was another, a new one, which wasn't there when I was there first. And it had been designed for electricity. And its bedrooms had very low roofs because it was assumed that they'd all have fans, you see. Well, you had to have a mosquito net as well, of course, because it wouldn't have been enough. They didn't seem to remember that. What, they weren't really high enough. The only high room was the living room, which had a punker in it. And it got frightfully hot. It went up to, before we left Ambala, that day it was 118 in the shade, so you can imagine that it wasn't very comfortable without electricity and without, from the point of view of the bedroom, even a punker. Couldn't have it, because there wasn't room for it.
What kind of social life did you have as RAF officers in India at that time?
Oh, same as everybody else did. It was very largely based on the club. There was always a club in any cantonment, and it was a sort of great meeting place for everybody, all the officers of all the services that were there, you see. That was to say the army, the British Army, the Indian Army, and ourselves at that time. And we used to have dances every Saturday night and all that sort of thing. Get together, we used to go down to the club pretty well every evening, every other evening to see our friends and have a drink and that sort of thing. Very, very, very sociable.
How did you get on with the officers from the other services?
Oh, very well. Very well.
There weren't cliques of RAF officers and separate ones?
No, not on the whole, no. No, we on the whole, we mixed up extremely well. And, of course, a lot of us had the same interests, you see, like riding and that sort of thing. Those who didn't ride, I think, had, in the Air Force, didn't have quite such a jolly time as some of us who did, because we weren't quite so mixed up with the others during the daytime. But they mixed themselves up in the evenings, all right. The club just same as we did.
What about sport? Did you play much sport?
Oh, yes, we're always playing sports, playing games, of course, with the men, and it was one of the great things that one had to do. And one of the great ways in which one got kept all the time in touch with the men from both the work point of view and the sport point of view, and played a lot of games with them.
What sports did you play?
Oh, well, I was never a cricketer in those days. I didn't go in for that, but we used to play football and rugger and hockey. Hockey was a really popular game in India. And we had great fun with it. And, of course, tennis. But that wasn't so much for the men. They didn't have so much tennis. We had tennis courts at the clubs. Very few people had their own tennis court in those days, all at the club.
Was it not a bit hot for rugby, though? Or was that played in
played in the cold weather. Yeah. It was hot. I mean, comparatively. But it was quite cool enough to have a good game of rugger.
Let's talk now then a bit about the business side, as it were. What kind of work were you involved in, first of all, in with regard to close cooperation work with the army? What kind of things did that involve for you as a squadron?
Well, it might involve spotting for guns, or cooperating with an advanced column moving somewhere, that sort of thing. And we would go and reconnoitre the area for them and tell them where the enemy was, if there was one. This is in training, I'm talking of, So there would be somebody representing an enemy, probably somewhere. You'd come back and give them information, which you'd only drop to them in a message bag. Because we had no... We did have wireless of a sort, operated with a key, you know. No radio telephony in those days at all. And that's all you could do. But we did a great deal, most of our messages were dropped. Well, then we couldn't pick up a message in those days. That came later on.
Did you actually do any of this ever on active service as opposed to training?
Yes, we did. I remember on an occasion I was engaged in escorting one of the columns in Waziristan itself, moving from one place to another. And we had to reconnoiter all round them to see if there was any opposition in the hills from the Pathans, the various tribesmen. We didn't do very much of that. It all depended on where you were, you know. I mean, there was nothing of that in Peshawar or around Peshawar itself so much. But when you got into the tribal territory, well, Peshawar itself as a base was not in tribal territory in the sense of that it was surrounded by... It's very difficult to describe it. It wasn't right in the middle of the tribal territory, it was on the edge, as it were. But in Waziristan itself, and we had one or two aerodromes inside Waziristan, then of course that was right in the tribal territory, and if a column had to move, we used to go out and escort them, to help them to protect themselves.
Presumably you had to do the reconnaissance flying at a fairly low level. Were you ever shot at? Were you in danger at that level?
No, I don't suppose I was very much. I dare say I must have been in danger if there'd been anybody to shoot at me, but I don't think I ever came across anybody who was feeling that way inclined that day. When I did it, if you see what I mean.
Yes, fairly arbitrary who they might shoot at,
yeah.
I think.
And of course, they'd only have a rifle to shoot with, so they didn't have machine guns in those days. And though they did shoot people, the aeroplanes were hit from time to time. But the thing that worried one more than anything else was if one had an engine failure and had to land in tribal territory. That could be rather unpleasant.
Did that ever happen to you?
Oh, no, not me. No, it didn't. I was very lucky. I didn't have any trouble. The only thing was that in one expedition we did, 2 or 3 days of this work, moving a column, escorting a column up from one place to another, we had to fly at about 4,000 feet and it was in the hot weather. And the engine boiled up to 5,000 or 6,000 feet, you see. And so you had to keep on gliding down to cool it down a bit, and then as soon as you started up again, it would come up and boil. If it had gone on too long, I dare say that we might have had some forced landing.
Did you actually take part in the sort of independent air control operations against rebel villages?
Yes, I did, a few times, for bombing raids against tribal targets.
Was this a frequent occurrence or not?
No, not very frequent. It was not air control as we understood it in Iraq, for example. That really was air control. And the whole system of keeping control was was changed there. It was, mind you, the country wasn't the same. It wouldn't have worked quite the same in India in any case. But the difference being that if the army were doing it on their own, there was some row in one of the tribal areas, all they could do was to send a column of troops up into the area and perhaps have a scrap, or certainly have a scrap of some sort. And some of it was very highly dangerous undertaking and very expensive, of course. Whereas if we did a successful bit of bombing, it might save the special column going right into the depths of the country. The army always had, and I think would continue to have, certain places within where they were permanently established, you see. And then they could branch out from one to another. But if they wanted to go a bit deeper in, I hope that they've now learned that the air is very useful for that sort of thing.
What form did the bombing operations that you took part in, what form did they actually take? Can you describe a typical one?
Well, the target was usually a village, or possibly it might be crops outside the village. But mostly the buildings. And it was really a matter of making the tribesmen thoroughly uncomfortable, turning them out of their villages. They had nowhere else to live except under a rock, and then they'd be inclined to come back and say, all right, well, we behave ourselves for a time. And that usually worked very well. It was not. It was very... there were great misunderstandings about it, especially at home. People said it was a very cruel thing to do. It was bombing civilians, and especially women and children. And they always thought we could select women and children from the air, very great heat, which was, of course, was nonsense. But in point of fact, of course, they didn't know that all these people, and the tribesmen knew just about as much about it as we did. They'd all been warned to get out of their villages, but if they didn't behave themselves, plenty of warning at masses of time they were given, and eventually one said, well, either you come to heel, if you don't, we are going to bomb your village, and it'll be done in a fortnight's time or whatever, so give an ample notice for them to get out. You get out, you will be perfectly safe. But you won't find that your homes have been destroyed when you get back, that's all. That was sort of, put it in very simple language. That was the principle of the thing.
Did you do these operations as a complete squadron?
Well, it depended on how big an operation it was, really. You could send a complete squadron, but it wouldn't fly as rule in those days. As a squadron, as a tactical unit of squadron, it would fly in three tactical units of flights of about five aircraft each, that sort of thing, you see. So that you'd all follow each other in, possibly at various intervals, sometimes close, sometimes not so close, for strategical and tactical reasons, that would be whichever was thought best, but not as a rule as a complete squadron.
What sort of level did you, what sort of height did you do the bombing?
Well, that again depended entirely, I suppose, that's taking my memory back rather far. I should think we must have dropped our bombs from, say, anything from 5 to 2,000 feet above the target, wherever that was. I mean, the target might be several thousand feet up in the hills, you see. So, something like that.
D- Did you try and aim for particular targets within a village, or were you just generally directing
Well,
your bombs at
sometimes
things?
one would be briefed on what the village was like and then what the most important buildings were, and perhaps you would try and make that your target. In fact, I should think, speaking again entirely from memory, we probably were given specific targets, but they weren't always easy to identify, and if the bombs did just hit a number of mud huts, which they mostly were, then you'd done something.
Could you, in fact, get a
Reduce a
reasonable
bit
degree
of
of
discomfort, what?
yes. Could you, in fact, get a reasonable degree of accuracy then, or was it things too
No,
primitive?
I don't think it was very accurate. I don't know. I wouldn't say. Bombing didn't become very accurate, you know, until well into the Second World War. Not really accurate, so that you can imagine that it couldn't have been very accurate there. And of course, our sighting arrangements were pretty primitive, but they were all right. We did hit our targets, and
You
but
were
we.
able to hit
Well,
some
yes,
of them.
we did hit them all right, but whether we hit the exact and whether you wouldn't call it precision bombing, if you see what I mean.
And did you hear, after you'd done one of these operations, did you hear from the political agent whether they'd had the desired effect?
Oh yes, we used to get news of them if they were successful, and by and large, I think they were. I didn't do a great many of those myself, but I mean, it just if it came one's way, and squadron was in the right place, and we just did it.
During this period, the RAF was extremely short of money in the early 1920s, kept very short of money in India. Were you conscious of this? Did this affect your squadron in any way?
Yes, it affected us all. There were certain things that we knew we really needed, and we didn't always have them, or there weren't enough spare parts or something of that sort. That was a common complaint. Now, one thing I can think of, we were talking just now about an engine boiling at low altitude during hot weather. There was a bigger radiator in use at home in England, I believe, and we didn't have any. Well, that's why we really wanted them, and that was why we had this trouble with radiators. Now, eventually, towards the end of my time, they did get some of those things. It made a great deal of difference to being able to operate effectively, that you could maintain a low altitude even in the hot weather, and do your job more efficiently. So that's just one example. I can't remember the others, as I say, in general terms, spare parts were things that very often weren't available, and one had to improvise, and wasn't very satisfactory.
Were you able to keep most of the planes in your squadron were
Serviceable?
serviceable at the same time, or did you have to take parts from one
Well,
and put on another?
you couldn't always, because of this lack of spares. Sometimes there was something you couldn't improvise on, and you just had to it had to sit on the floor, which is of course a very uneconomical way of using aircraft, and it's quite ridiculous not to have a big range of spares, but money isn't always there to give them.
What were the most common things that were lacking in the way of spares? Can you remember anything in particular that you couldn't get hold
No,
of?
I really can't. Not in particular. I remember that radiator trouble, and of course, in this my second tour in India, which we haven't really come to later on, 7 years later on, brakes had arrived on aeroplanes. Brakes were then in use at home. Again, where we wanted them, particularly for flying into advanced landing grounds, which would be probably very small. We had no brakes, and several aeroplanes were damaged, not lost, but damaged quite badly enough, and had to be got back or repaired on the spot. And simply because we couldn't stop. We ran off, even if we landed on the edge of the aerodrome, a slightly fast landing would take you out, over into a nullah or something, nullah being a ditch, a big riverbed, really.
That was when you were operating with Wapiti. You were operating with Wapitis.
We were Wapitis, yeah. Well, Wapitis had brakes, really, at home. I mean, there were Wapitis with brakes, but we didn't have them. And that's why we really needed them, much more than they did here, in many ways.
Could you not convince the army or, I mean, the government of India,
government,
really,
was it? Yeah. Well, the government of India was short of money, and I suppose that the powers that be, the Air Force powers that were in those days, couldn't convince them, or couldn't persuade them to see the daylight and see that it really was necessary to have these things. And then, of course, one or two airplanes came, and they were permanently designed and fitted with brakes anyway, so then that particular thing died a natural death, because the old Wapiti didn't go on all that long, and I dare say someday perhaps they may have got a few with brakes. I really don't know. But there was a thing called the Hart, which was another aeroplane, which we didn't have in the Army Cooperation Squadrons, but they did have brakes. Now, they had them anyway, so that if India wanted them, they had to buy them with brakes. That's what it amounted to.
At the end of 1923, then, you returned to England, and you went to the RAF establishment, the apprentices' school at Halton.
Yes.
What was your post there and your duties?
An administrative post entirely, not technical. The school was a technical school, as you probably know, but though after all, the boys had lived somewhere, and they lived in barracks, which were looked after by non-technical officers, of whom I was one. And it was all at the administrative side, drill and discipline and all that sort of thing, and of course feeding and provision of accommodation.
Was there, in fact, a good deal of drill and that kind of thing there?
Well, compared to what there is now, I suppose there was a good deal of drill, and it wasn't overdone, I don't think. Well, it couldn't be, really, because the boys had spent most of their time down at the workshops or in school. There was an ordinary civilian school run by the Air Force, I mean, by civilian schoolmasters within the organisation. And they were very particular that